Welcome back to this week's episode of the Data Protection Media Easy podcast with me, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Philip Brining and Joe Kirk. Hello to both of you.
Hello, hello. A Sunday name for me, hey?
I know, hello. I thought I'd go official for once.
But I thought that was a good session. We covered, we had some good brain teaser stuff, you know, we had some good kind of theoretical academic discussion, which we always like. But what did you guys think?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Breaches aren't as straightforward as you might think. You know, first of all, people think that some people think that it's just, you know, the massive ransomware attacks and so on that, you know, our systems are
compromised,
yeah. But it's also the low level things and the low level, you know, human error, sending emails to the wrong people, and it's how do you actually mitigate them or prevent them from happening. It's a tricky one. So we spoke loads about that, flew a few ideas around, and probably didn't reach a conclusion. it continues.
What did you think, Joe?
Yeah, we sat and picked apart the definition, actually probably for about 20 minutes, didn't we, trying to define actually what security means. And it's not as well, it maybe it is as easy as it is, but we sat and went quite deep, didn't we, and maybe a little bit too granular as opposed to what the GDPR means by a breach of security. But it's important to know, because it underpins, doesn't it, as opposed to whether you actually have to do anything off the back of the incident or not.
Well, I think it was, you know, I think part of these sessions is to go granular, you know, to help the practitioners in the community to, you know they're not the only ones thinking what is actually meant by the word security. You know, it's unclear, it's left unfinished in the GDPR. I mean, we didn't even get onto the definition of personal data, which again is unfinished. I was dying to get onto that subject. Yeah, okay, it's just we just go to the blah 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 of personal data. Well, what is personal data was my next question, was going to be my next question, because again, I think that's it's kind of left hanging, and data changes its nature, doesn't it? And that's what, you know, what we're trying to do with these sessions sometimes is help people kind of think outside the box, and, you know, just spend an hour a week maybe just thinking about things in a different way, or prompting some thought process that might not have occurred because of the day-to-day pressures.
Yeah, I mean, we find it just as useful, you know, people contributing in the chat with their opinions as well, because as you say, we're all in the same situation. I think that's why so many people enjoy the podcast, of things aren't straightforward and, you know, there aren't answers to everything. We just need to float ideas about and try and be as consistent as possible, really.
Yeah, and share ideas and share thoughts. I thought, you know, we had some really good chat again. So thanks to everyone who contributed in that. Some great stuff that's coming up. And that discussion in the very outset about you know, bots recording WebExes and webinars. Again, fascinating, really, to think that one through.
No, it was a great session. Hopefully, you know, we probably will talk about this again in the future, because as you say, we didn't even cover half of what we wanted to, but still, it was a great topic, great discussion.
Because Joe was rabbiting on. You can't shut him up, can you?
That's rich, isn't it, coming
from you
two? Everybody,
be prepared for a very excitable fill this session.
What are we doing next week?
So next week is a GDPR radio again. So we discussed a little bit of news. We'll go into that in more detail next week. But for now, enjoy Don't Let the Breach Break You. Sounds like a song title. Enjoy. So this week's episode is Don't Let the Breach Break You, in which we're going to discuss, you know, the ins and outs of personal data breaches and the common issues we face, everything around it, what it means and so on. But before we start, I'd like to let everyone know that the session is recorded. So if anybody's got any issues with that, please do let us know after the session. There is a privacy notice on screen. And yeah, let's get started. I think I've remembered everything for probably the first time ever.
Very good. I've already got a hand up, and Stella's made an announcement. So Dave, do you want to say something?
It was just an interesting point that came up in a meeting I was in yesterday, a different forum, around the privacy notices, things we were just talking about it. It started off a conversation around the fact that there are various bots available now that will effectively attend a meeting on your behalf and, you know, transcribe that meeting and give you notes from that meeting. And apparently some of these bots can also record meetings. Even if you are not the owner, who would normally be the person who has the rights to record a meeting.
Right.
So an interesting thought around the fact that, yeah, you put up the policy to say this is being recorded, you consent to being recorded. If you're in a meeting that's more confidential that you don't want recorded, is there worth putting up some kind of notice that says, if you get a recording of this meeting, it wasn't us, because we're not recording it.
And it's interesting, isn't it? That's a very interesting point. So whoever's doing the recording, you know, or driving in control of these bots is obviously acting in the capacity as of a data controller, I would say. So, you know, if they record the data, they would have to put up a privacy notice to say, oh, by the way, my bot is recording the meeting for these purposes and so forth. And just to be clear, we're not relying on consent here, because it's just too complicated to obtain consent. We could say if you attend, then obviously you have consented. So what our privacy notice says is that we're relying on legitimate interest of the audience, the community, ourselves, the participants. And we have taken them down in the past. We have, in fact, we've taken one down where we'd received an objection from one of the guests on the thing who wanted the recording taken out, which we did. You know, we thought, fair enough, you know, we actually thought we've probably got strong grounds to say we're not taking it down, but we thought, no, this is not, that's not necessary, you know, it's not actually a problem for taking it down. We'll re-record the session without that participant, which we did. It was on Ropers, I think, I can't remember, or data assets. But it's interesting thought, what's kind of your position on it, that you'd put up a statement saying, you know, any recordings of this aren't authorized by us, we're not a data controller that's recorded it, and if you want to record it, then you need to make that clear to the participants. Is that what your approach would be?
Yeah, because I think there is, you know, talking about data breach, there's a potential for data breach if someone records the meeting unwittingly. Other people in the meeting aren't aware they're being recorded. They may say things they wouldn't, because the forum I was on, it has like Chatham House rules, because we're discussing quite confidential stuff.
Yeah.
So it, by default, it's not recorded. But, you know, there's any number of bits of software you can stick on your laptop that will record what's going on the screen.
Yeah, that's
so
really...
if you set no recording, it's not hard for someone to record a meeting without your knowledge.
That's very concerning, isn't it? I guess you would probably put up some sort of statement at the start of the meeting, but... Yeah, so it's kind of a non-compliance. This is like invisible processing, isn't it? Processing without appropriate privacy notices, and then if there was any loss of confidentiality or integrity, or you know, we're going to come into this, then that, you know, theoretically would, well, it wouldn't necessarily be a personal data breach, because you know there's not necessarily any breach of security, but these are the types of things we want to get into and talk about on today's session.
Yeah, that was an interesting point. Anyway.
No, it's fascinating. Yeah, we could talk all afternoon about this, to be honest. So thanks for raising it. Stella's raised. Yeah, Stella's raised. Were you going to mention this, Jasmine?
Yeah,
before
go on.
Go on now, carry on. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Stella's raised in the chat that, well, she's asked the question to say, whilst we wait to start to plug a link to a data protection apprentice advertised for Taurus.
Got a job.
Right, yeah, okay. Needs to be within communicating distance of Liverpool and St. Helens to attend. Sorry, commuting. My brain today. I'm trying to... needs to be within commuting distance of Liverpool and St. Helens to attend office one or two days a week on where business needs, and then a link to it. Yeah.
So what kind of level are you looking for, Stella? Right, is it a young apprentice or a mature? Have you got any profile? Are you not allowed to say what
I can say. So, yeah, it's,
we're amongst friends. Oh, we are recording this as well, by the way.
Yeah, no, it's fine. It's to do the level 4 data protection and information governance practitioner course. So it would need somebody that's got GCSEs, English and maths, and possibly A levels, or unless it's somebody that's obviously older and has experience that can then do the level 4 qualification.
Which apprenticeship are you putting them on then? The Daymar one or the one that, is it Barry Malt's got one as well, hasn't he? Can't remember what that one's called.
At the moment, I think Taurus have got 3 providers that we've reached out to. Daymar is the only one that's responded as yet. So it just depends what they've got to offer in terms of the provider. But at the moment, it looks like it might be Daymar.
Yeah, they've done put some good apprentices into us, actually, to be fair, Daymar. Well, good luck with that. If there's anybody on or listening that's interested, then reach out to Stella. Presumably, you can just get onto the Taurus website, Stella, can they?
Yeah, you can just click on that link and then just apply through via that link.
Right. Oh, look at this. We've already got a Daymar apprentice here. Emma. Well done, Emma. Anyway, we could talk about anything you want all afternoon. It's your session, not ours, but... anything you've seen in the news this week? I tell you what I noticed in the Guardian that the police in the Metropolitan Police are proposing to use facial recognition technologies in the coronation. That's Saturday, isn't it? That tomorrow?
Yes. Right. What for?
I'm not sure.
Just observing, just is it?
Yeah, monitoring the crowds, I think. You know, I don't think that the article actually specifies. It's probably been here. I'm just interested to see, because we talked the other week, didn't we, that the Olympic Committee proposing to use, or in Paris, they're proposing to use facial recognition technology in the Olympics, aren't they, next year? In fact, for a year to monitor things in Paris.
Yeah.
And if they've considered all the data protection implications of that, you know, of their track record, well, it'll be interesting to see or to look into at least.
Yeah, I'm sure that they have. I mean, it says that the Met insisted the technology would not be used to quell lawful protest or target activists. So it doesn't say what it will be used for, but it does say what it won't be used for.
Right.
Yeah, I'd like to see a privacy notice.
Yeah, but this is just growing and growing, isn't it? You know, I said to you last week, actually, I was at a very small convenience store in Lancaster, and there was an enormous notice on the door about facial recognition technology for effectively looking out for known shoplifters. So it's a growing thing, a growing issue, I'd have thought, problem.
Yeah, I think I've seen in the news today, not today, this week, that that the EU have published a new draft of the AI Act that's based on I guess a level of risk. So, you know, for something that's low risk AI, then there's not really any legislation around it or measures around it, unless it's you know, extremely high risk or concerning, and then there's, you know, it's basically leveled off like that. So I'm intrigued to read more into it. I've only had a look at the highlights of it, but yeah, so that's something to look out for as well. I've also seen that ChatGPT is back in business in Italy as well.
Any comment about the reinstating of it?
So,
I think they were satisfied, weren't they, of the privacy concerns that were originally brought up by the supervisory authority.
The Garante, yeah. Mm. Yeah, okay. No, that's interesting, isn't it? So that was a short-lived ban, wasn't it?
I know. Have you seen anything else in the news?
Oh, go on.
No, you find out.
It's always hard to get a word in between you two, isn't it? Yeah, so the UK's king, King Charles, has attempted to prevent his son, the Duke of Essex, from taking legal action against newspapers over alleged phone hacking. It's emerged that Prince Harry is currently suing the publisher of The Sun over alleged unlawful information gathering, I presume around his son, I think that is. He told the court he was summoned by Buckingham Palace and told to drop the case because of the effect on the family. The case is one of three major cases that Prince Harry has made against tabloids and newspapers, all alleging unlawful information gathering.
Right.
The plot thickens.
It does. I got asked to comment on the decision that is due out next week, it's the 12th, about Meta and the transfer of data and the applicability of standard contractual clauses. So yeah. I have to say I wasn't particularly familiar. So I got asked to write a piece for an article, 100-word article. I thought, oh, blimey, I'm not at all up to speed with this. So I started doing a little bit of digging about on what this was about. Are you familiar with it? You know, this is continuation of the striking down of the, you know, the Privacy Shield and that.
Yeah.
And basically what I wrote in this article, which I don't know if it's going to get published or not, but I mean, I thought, well, I shall give it a whirl, is that it doesn't, you know, to some extent, it doesn't really matter what the decision is. This is something, again, hopefully for discussion. It doesn't really matter what the decision is. For me, the important thing, because the European Data Protection Board's decisions don't mean anything to us in practice, do they, now we're outside of the European Union?
Mm.
But if it's, you know, really compelling legal argument about the underpinning circumstances, then we couldn't fail but to observe it, because we've got effectively identical law. So the decision itself might not apply to us, but if the underpinning logic and rationale for reaching the decision and the legal arguments are absolutely 100% watertight and valid, then how can it not affect us? Was basically what I wrote in this article in 100 words, which was quite good going for me.
Well, I know. Well, we see. We see most EU guidance is persuasive still, don't we? It's still very relevant.
Yeah, it is.
So it'd be stupid not to. There wouldn't be a reason not to, really. So yeah, we'll see how it progresses. But
yeah,
obviously with the data reform bill, I don't know. I don't know what changes will come, but
yeah, we will see. Anyway, we'll see.
It's interesting you say that, Phil, actually, about the EU-US privacy shield, because this week I've been doing some project work. I've been doing some due diligence for one of our customers on a variety of platforms such as Google and Eventbrite. And upon doing the due diligence, I've seen on Google's website that they're still stating that they are relying on the privacy shield framework for EU-US transfers, which was very surprising to me, obviously, because Schrems 2 invalidated the framework in terms of
Google's.
Google. Yeah. All right. I've actually got it up. I had a look and I've got it up in front of me. I can share screen if you want to have a read of what they say.
That's strange. We'll maybe have a look. Yeah. That's very strange, isn't it, that they're still referring to.
Yeah. I tell you what, I'll just put a link in the chat for people to go and have a look. But Eventbrite had the same. They said they're still relying on that. And it was. It surprised me, especially Google, you know, the size of the organization.
Yeah, Google are usually aware. Yeah, I've been to privacy conferences where, you know, the head of privacy at Google has made some really, really good speeches. I've come across Eventbrite quite a lot, but I've got no opinion on their kind of the way that they approach privacy. But I think Google, you know, I think that they seem to try hard whenever I've come across them.
I mean, but they've been under the cosh, haven't they, recently with data protection laws, so within data protection requirements and stuff, with fines they've received. So you'd think that they'd be hot on the press, but I don't know. It's weird.
Strange. What else have I seen? I saw a few of the bits and pieces. I mean, I think maybe we'll leave until next week and some. I can't think of anything. I noticed that, interesting, and kind of related, that the EU's Committee on Civil Liberties, Justice and Home Affairs, called Libby Committee, passed a resolution to stop the debate. We might have talked this before, over the draft adequacy decision. So it seems like that's kind of run into the buffers now. We talked briefly last week about there's a raft of US states that are introducing various kind of state-based data protection laws. So again, that's probably something to pick up in a GDPR radio session.
Yeah, next week we can do that. Should we go into the main bulk of the session?
Yeah, we could. Final thing I saw is that the Canadian Privacy Commissioner has lost a case in Canada where they were pursuing Facebook or Meta for kind of an unlawful posting of data, mostly kind of collecting and sharing data. Of course, the Canadian law is totally different from the GDPR, so it could well be that it doesn't, you know, what they're doing is compliant with the Canadian law. But again, it's just interesting that, you know, in one jurisdiction, you know, a practice is law, for another jurisdiction it's not, you know, and the courts rule in different ways. It's an obvious point, I suppose. Anyway, yes, Phil, it's very obvious. Moving on.
Okay, so let's get into personal data breaches then. So should we start by just discussing what is a personal data breach? I mean, to me, you know, there's a common misinterpretation or misunderstanding of between, you know, a general data protection compliance breach, so a breach of the GDPR, compared to an actual
non-compliant
personal, a personal data breach itself. So, do you want to explain what a personal data breach is, Joe? I'll let you speak.
I mean, it's a fairly obvious thing, isn't it, Joe?
Thanks, Jasmine. well, it does seem like it, but I think we have some cases that kind of make us think a little bit, don't we, as opposed to whether they are a breach or not. So the way we treat it kind of as a two-part test, don't we, really, is that the first part is it a breach of security? Which, you know, from just looking at it, that seems quite an obvious yes or no answer, but I don't think it is it?
No, we can get into that. So before the definition is a breach of security that's leading to the accidental or unlawful destruction, loss, alteration, unauthorized disclosure of, or access to personal data transmitted, stored, or otherwise processed. So that's the overall definition under Article 412. And we just break that down to consider, okay, has this definition actually been met? So the first part, as you say, Joe, has there been a breach of security? So what actually is security, really? I mean, you think it's self-explanatory, but when you break it down, there are different elements to it.
So that's the first measure, would it be, Joe? You know, has there been a breach of security? So, you know, what are we looking at here? You know, then if there has been a breach of security, has it led to the accidental loss, et cetera, et cetera, of personal data?
So we break it down in terms of what is security. So that's confidentiality, availability or integrity, and sometimes resilience is considered within that as well. So confidentiality, you know, that's self-explanatory. Availability, you could say so as well. So is the personal data available to you or not? And integrity, is it accurate? Is it accurate as it initially was, or has it been, you know, altered in some way? So these are the things that we consider. So
yeah, but all this stuff is easy to say. Oh, it's confidentiality, integrity, availability, CIA. You know, but what actually is security? And surely, you know, we are encouraged and instructed to put technical and organizational measures in place to protect personal data, protect it from what, you know, from accidental loss disclosure, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, how does that translate? You know, what technical measures are there? What organizational measures are there? How do you determine, you know, what's what? I mean, one of the perverse things potentially is, you know, if you don't have a breach of security, maybe it's because you had no security in place.
I think it depends on the organization as well, doesn't it, as opposed to what you have in place and what sort of data you're processing. In terms of because it's the word appropriate, right, which is contextual. So if you're processing fairly low level data, you've just got names and email addresses and addresses and contact details and things like that, the organizational measures you need to have in place to keep that data secure are going to be a lot less stringent, as opposed to if you're a hospital and you've got, you know, thousands of health records, where you'll probably have a lot more security measures in place to ensure the data remains secure.
I think as well, you know, for people who don't really know much about data protection in general, you know, technical and organizational measures might just seem, you know, a foreign statement that you get what it's, you know, what it's getting
at. Tongue, doesn't
you
it?
Understand the gate, what it's what it's alluding to, but you don't know what that actually means in practice. So I think the approach that we tend to take is, you know, you've got your technical measures, so that could be password protection, it can be encryption, antivirus software and all those kinds of things, and then physical measures such as locked doors, you know, locked filing cabinets, key cards and so on. And then your organizational measures would be more like policies and procedures and contracts and those kinds of things. So they're what we look to when we consider whether there's been a breach of security.
And what Joe's just said is that it's horses for courses. You know, what's right for some you know, personal data and processing activities. I mean, it's not just data we're trying to protect, it's the actual processing activities as well, isn't it? So, you know, you often go into, have you ever been to a contact center where you've got, you know, limited access to rooms, you don't have mobile phones in there, and, you know, they've got no storage facilities, they've got no pens, they can't do anything because anything above and beyond, you know, a very controlled environment is a risk. So, but you don't need that necessarily for everything. In fact, one of the requirements of the PCI DSS is that anybody processing cardholder data is in a kind of an enclosed environment, you know, and only authorized people can access that room. Now, that's kind of a hybrid technical control. You might have pass keys and RFID passes and so on and so forth, but it also might be a policy that, you know, no authorized people can access this space. Same with server rooms. You know, so you're relying on a kind of a hybrid blend of tech and org measures, which you then have to define. You'd imagine this massive matrix of, you know, what processing activities, what type of data, what are the control measures, you know, which ones are we applying to what? So, you know, is it complex or are we overcomplicating it? I don't know really, but, you know, you've folder sharing rules.
Yeah, I don't know if we're overcomplicating it. I think it comes down to some level of common sense, really. You know, like you say, Joe, you've got to consider the level of risk associated with personal data and then what measures are appropriate for that and relevant, really.
But I mean, let's take like a common occurrence. Cause, sorry, Joe, if you want to speak, you have to dive in and
your
way into the conversation. And then we'll shut up and let you go. But I mean, if you look at some common breaches like emails, right? Emailing to the wrong people, you know, all CC'd in with an attachment. This happens all the time, doesn't it? You know, what is the breach of security? You know, is it a breach of a work practice, you know, a policy of not sending attachments containing sensitive information outside of the organization via email? You know, is it what is the breach?
Yeah, it's tricky in those situations because you can put in as many measures as you want or you can, but there's just always going to be that level of human error that, you know, can seep its way through, and there's only so much control you can have over that. But at the end of the day, you know, there's been a breach of confidentiality in that instance. So
yeah, there has undoubtedly a breach of confidentiality, but was it caused by a breach of security? Was it caused by a lapse in the, you know, was it caused by a security control failing to meet its security objectives? That surely must be the definition of a security breach.
I mean, it's a tricky one, isn't it? Because you get it on 4 p.m. on a Friday afternoon. I'm hoping one's not coming.
Oh, blimey, fingers
today,
crossed.
I know, it's always the way, isn't it? But you know, maybe in that sense you can say, you know, that they've not had enough training, or they've got the pre-populated, you know, the, I don't know what the proper term is for it, but pre-populated
auto-fill.
Emails.
Yeah,
that's it. Autofill, thank you. So autofill, maybe you need to just completely remove
that. That's me on a bad morning. I just go into autofill.
So it's just one of those that you know. I mean, I see it with one of my customers, a council. So they have so many breaches through just, you know, sending the wrong emails, and they provide training to people who have committed the breaches and so on. Obviously, always accidental in these instances, sending an email to the wrong person, but they come to me and say, what more can we do? And I think there's just got to be a level of accepting that is always going to happen. But at least in those instances, they're acknowledging the fact that there has been a breach. Because
yeah. Well, listen, I was... Go on. No, you finish your sentence.
You're too excitable, Phil.
I'm on one today. like every day.
Yeah. I've lost my train of thought. Go on.
Now, I was just saying that, going to say that this morning, Joe asked me to have a read through a data protection impact assessment for a customer. And one of the risks identified was that they were sending data via email to a health professional, and they'd highlighted that this was a risk, quite rightly, I think. But the mitigation was that this was a high risk on the original risk score. And then the mitigation was that there was going to be a delay put on the outbox. And they then said, well, that's going to definitely fix this problem. So the likelihood of this occurring is, you know, we're going to rate it as low. And I thought to myself, and I'm interested in your views on this, I thought, no, that's not really an effective control. I mean, it's okay if you suddenly realise that you've emailed the wrong person. You know, a pause on the outbox of a minute will enable you to go in. But if you don't notice that, it's not good enough.
Yeah.
You know, so
yeah,
I was saying...
Yeah, a lot of the time it's, you know, it'll be the same first name or something like that, you know, that they sent it to. And they won't think anything of it until that person raises it with them and says, I don't think this was meant for me. Or at least you hope that they'll raise it anyway.
And how often do you actually check back the person you've sent an email to? If you send it off and it's got a delay, you're not going to, let me just double check.
At that point in time.
Exactly that.
Blimey, what have I done? Yeah.
Although the amount of times I send an email and as soon as I press send, I realise something that I've missed or not done is ridiculous. It's honestly something about that send button. It does make something click in my brain.
Confiscate her laptop off her.
Happily, I'll finish early.
Disaster waiting to happen. But we long weekend. But yeah, I mean, I was wondering whether, I mean, this is easy for us to say, isn't it, as advisors, but, you know, have you considered using secure email? You know, is email the best way of transferring this data between these parties? You know, should you be using a more secure method where you've got control over, read-only rights? How do you stop people forwarding it on? These are the risks associated with email.
Would it not make sense just to have a secure Dropbox that you can just populate the data into, like OneDrive, for example, or...
File sharing system.
Yeah, because sometimes with secure emails, you know, if I get sent one through Egress from someone external, we don't use Egress internally, but I can just set up an account and then access the email if they've sent it to me. So I don't fully understand how effective that is, except for maybe the fact that it's encrypted and transmit or what.
I mean, I just wonder why, and I'm not having a pop here, but I mean, you know, it just makes me wonder I mean, I've got quite a technical level of understanding because of the background I've had in database design development and security and all that type of stuff. And I don't suppose every DPO has that ability to say, actually, a better control would be, you know, proper role-based access control. I know what it is. I've seen it in practice. So, you know, we're asking people to read these DPIAs and comment on them. So the fact that the risk was basically, you know, there's risk of this happening. And the mitigation was, you know, we're only sending data to internal email addresses. Oh, how's that a mitigation? And, you know, we're putting a pause on the outbox. But is that just a lack of understanding, or is it a let's get rid of this DPA as soon as we can and get on with the project?
Yeah.
What is driving that kind of thought process when you're looking at, you know, what could go wrong with using email to transfer medical data about sensitive and vulnerable individuals?
Probably the second one, Phil. Get it out of the way. Get it done.
But I don't know. I wouldn't like to say it could be just a technical lack of understanding. You know, I don't know, but.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was
Adele's made a good point in the chat saying that they debated turning off the autofill, but then decided that manually keying in email addresses could potentially create a higher risk of error, which is true.
That's a good point. I did an audit at a housing association actually a few years ago, and they did switch off autofill, and the data protection officer got a complete, you know, barrage of abuse. But I think in the long term it worked for them. But you know, it's hard to maintain, isn't it? I mean, the autofill seems automatically on, and if you click on the X next to an email address, it doesn't necessarily kill it out of your autofill list, does it?
So my brain was moving ahead there.
You've taken us off down a tangent, Jasmine.
What were we talking about?
What is a breach of security, were we?
So what is a breach of security? So go on, Joe.
No, well, I was just going to say, as we have just sat and spoke for 15, 20 minutes about what a breach of security is, whether it meets the definition of a personal data breach under UK GDPR is if it leads to the accidental or unlawful destruction, loss, alteration, unauthorized disclosure of or access to personal data. So what we've just said there and spoke about, you know, what is security, and those things might occur quite commonly. It's only a personal data breach if the second part of the definition is met. And I think that's key to it, really, because we have quite a few breaches come through, don't we? Where customers ask for an opinion from us, and some of them stump us as to whether they're actually a breach or not. And I've got a couple of cases that I want your opinion on, and the chat as well. Please feel free to weigh in. So a customer of ours, the first one is a customer of ours, I think they moved office or something like that, and they had a wooden cabinet file of data, and it was locked, and a member of the public, I think it might have been a school actually, found the cabinet of data next to a fire pit. The box was locked, untampered, no evidence that anyone had actually been into the box and seen the data or accessed it or, you know, done anything along those lines. And I just wanted your opinion as to whether you thought that was a personal data breach or not.
So just let me get my head around this. And so a filing cabinet was found in a field, effectively, and by a school, and they opened the filing cabinet and found something that made them realise that it was personal data belonging to.
Yeah, I think there
company
was
X. They rang up company X and said, "I found this filing cabinet in this field," you know, and company X said, "Don't worry, we'll send a van down and pick it up," and that's what happened, is it?
Yeah, that's what happened.
Yeah. So it sounds to me like there's definitely been a breach of security. You know, there's been some failure of some, you know, measure that's meant to keep personal data within the confines of the business premises, I would have thought, although not knowing the full details, it's hard to say.
Yeah.
And, you know, did that lead to unauthorized access? Well, yes. If somebody opened a box and pulled out a document, what type of stuff was it? Bank details or medical details?
I think there was financial information in there.
So they must have realized whose it was and had access to it, you know, but they might have only looked at one page, so that's one person's data might have been compromised. And then they've reported it, and you know, somebody's come and uplifted it. So it sounds to me like it is a very possible personal data breach.
Yeah, because, you know, if they found a random filing cabinet, how would they know whose it is without getting into it, really, unless it's got branding on the side, which I doubt. But I'm intrigued to think, so if they didn't access any of the files and for some reason the logo was imprinted on the side,
sure,
then would that be a breach? Because, you know, the organization has lost the filing cabinet.
Yeah. But they've recovered it.
But it's a breach. It's a breach of security. You know, I think Fiona's saying absolutely spot on. You know, somehow they couldn't account for this filing cabinet. They might not even know they had it. They might not have even had information. They might not have known it had gone.
Yeah.
But irrespective of that, you know, this data has got out of the organisation and has ended up in a field. So it can't possibly be anything other than a breach of security. You must have control measures in place to limit that actually happening. So
yeah,
it must have been a breach of security.
Yeah,
but I'm not sure on that point.
Whether it led to the unauthorized access to destruction of et cetera, personal data, don't know the sufficient details, but somebody must have opened the carton of data to have a look at it, to know who to ring to say we found your data in the field.
Mm.
So to me, that there would have been a breach of confidentiality of at least, you know, one or a handful of records. But what you said is the other cartons didn't seem to be touched. Therefore, you know, it's not a, you know, if anyone wanted to use that data nefariously, they would have taken the boxes, wouldn't they?
Yes, or left it open with all the data gone.
Yeah.
I think, you know, if none of the cabinets had, if none of the drawers had been opened, it's still temporary loss. So if they needed it in that, you know, in that time, it was missing, then
it's a loss of data. Then
that breach has been mitigated rather than it not being a breach once it was found. That's the approach I would probably take.
Well, once you've got,
because you can't be sure either way, can you? So
no,
in those instances, I think you're best treating as a worst case scenario.
I think you're right as well, but I mean the mitigation bit is kind of like the next step of the process in my view. Let's say a personal data breach has occurred because there's been a loss of personal data, albeit temporary. So then we're saying the personal data breach has definitely occurred. Next question is it notifiable to the ICO? You know, on what we know what that says, you know, if there's no risk or is it unlikely? I can't remember how it's phrased.
It's unlikely to result in risk, unless it's unlikely to result in risk, you report a breach,
So again, looking at the circumstances, I feel like I'm in like one of those escape rooms trying to argue my way out of an escape room or work my way out of an escape room. And I would have said that it's not reportable because I would have said in those circumstances, no evidence of there being a risk to the rights and freedoms of anybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, we're taking a you know, a value-based judgment here, aren't we?
No, that's an interesting one, that. I think everyone in the chat's pretty much of the same opinion as well, to be honest.
Yeah.
And go on.
I was just going to say, I've got one more, and this one's quite an interesting one, actually. It might catch some of you out. Another customer of ours, one of their employees was out on a night out and got talking to the bouncer at a local bar. And it turned out the bouncer was a tenant of the organisation where the person worked at. I won't go into the details, but they got talking about some issues, and then the bouncer and the other half complained to the housing association. To which then they, you know, came to us and said, is this a breach? So I wanted to hear your guys' opinion on that as to whether the conversation that they had.
We'll mull on that one for a second. So Janice makes a really good point. You know, did anybody else come across, going back to the other example, did anybody else come across, you know, the cabinet? You know, you don't know, do you? So you know, there's no evidence that there was and no evidence that there wasn't.
Yeah.
And therefore you're in this invidious position as a data protection, you know, officer saying, well, you know, should we report it or not? You know, does it feel like there's a risk or not? You know, what's the likelihood? And if you've come down the side of actually we think there is, we know we're in a, given the nature of the data or given the scale of it or given that we have a risk averse culture here by default because of what we do, then you would probably choose to report it. But many other instances, like if it was just, you know, commercial, if it was a law firm, a doctor's surgery, a clinic, they'd probably take a different view from if it was, you know, a window, you know, installation company.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about the law is, and this is what the frustration with the data protection bill is, and it is really flexible. Yes, it's hard, but it's flexible. It's not an inflexible set of, you know, rules as has been characterized to be. The hard bit is stepping through it and reaching consistent decisions across different types of organizations, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, sorry, go on back to your other case.
No, it's all right.
Conversation.
So,
where?
Yeah.
Well, Fiona's just asked.
Was disclosed.
Yeah, Fiona's asked a question saying, depends on what was disclosed. They spoke about a matter with the property that the security guard was in. He was having issues with his house, and the employee of the housing association discussed the matters with the person and apologised for what happened. And then, you know, it came from that, really. So
I think the tricky thing here is, you know, they've got a duty of, a duty of confidentiality, and just through the nature of, you know, their employment contract, that they should be shouldn't really be discussing work matters and work or organizational information to anyone that's not really authorized to receive it. So that's I guess that needs to be taken into consideration. But is it processing?
Well, it's a verbal conversation. It's not data that's computerized, or, you know, it's not in a structured filing system. It is, but it's been verbalized. And I'm just wondering whether that means that actually that verbal conversation is outside of the scope of the GDPR.
Well,
I'm
glad you've both picked up on that, because that just, it relays the importance of, you know, really stripping it back and understanding what you're looking at to determine whether it's actually a personal data breach. So because both identified that it's not automated and it's not structured, therefore under Article 2 of the UK GDPR, it's not actually caught, and therefore it can't be a data protection breach or a personal data breach.
Jamie's kind of on the same page, really, I think that would be my first port of call, is to, you know, thoroughly investigate whether we think it's actually, you know, information that's regulated by the GDPR. I mean, it might well be, because it could be that, you know, that data is actually being computerized, and because, I mean, it does say, the intention to computerize, it's already computerized, it's been verbalized. But that's what I would start off with, probably, and then work down it from there. But some of this requires just a bit more investigation, doesn't it?
Yeah, Leslie said in the chat that they've had something similar. So the SCO said that if the verbal conversation is based on written information, then they said that it might be a breach of confidentiality rather than a personal data breach. So
I think it's interesting, especially
if you put that into a context in which they imagine a line manager discussing with another member of staff why a colleague is off ill. You know, that's really sensitive info. It could be really sensitive information that they might not be entitled to, because, you know, that individual, that colleague has, you know, rights to confidentiality. But would it be more likely to be a breach in a work setting? Or just the same?
Sorry, I wasn't listening. I was reading the chat. What
did
you say?
Oh, you're on one today, Phil. I'm only joking. No, so if in a work setting, you know, a line manager's talking to an employee about why their colleague is off ill, and it's, you know, really sensitive health reasons as to why they're off ill, then would that be more likely to be a personal data breach because it's within the context of you know, work setting, or does the same just apply? I don't know.
I think it seems wrong. I think the same applies. It doesn't necessarily seem right, but. For me, I think it's coming back to reading that definition of, you know, what is within the scope of the GDPR, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what I would be.
Yeah, it doesn't say unless it's in a work setting. If the conversation's in a work setting, then it's caught. So I agree.
Cheeky now. So Jamie said that wouldn't that fall under employment law and confidentiality rather than DPA, which I suppose
it might fall under both. I mean, it may or may not.
You have it in policy, maybe. You could have it in, I don't know, your data protection policy to say, you know, all employees are under a duty of confidentiality not to disclose information.
Well, they usually are, aren't they? You know, acceptable use and all that type of stuff.
So they
might well have breached the employment contract and their duty to confidentiality. Whether they've actually caused a personal data breach requires investigation, I think. But
yeah,
these are all really interesting things to have a look at. Go on then.
I think I might have spoken about it a few weeks ago, but it's really relevant today. So a customer of ours, a housing association, uses a supplier to fit sliding doors in properties, mostly for, you know, disabled, vulnerable people for accessibility reasons. So they'd send a ticket or a job to the supplier and say, you know, can you go to this address and fit this? They might add a flag to it to say, you know, this individual is in a wheelchair or whatnot, anything. And they hadn't heard anything back for about 2 weeks. So they just weren't getting, you know, they weren't receiving any responses to any emails. So they checked the website and found that the supplier had posted the fact that they'd had a malware attack, a ransom attack on the system. So they shut it down and, you know, they keep people updated as and when possible. The customer came to us and asked whether this is a personal data breach, whether they should report it to the ICO, what they should do, because they weren't sure whether it was whether their personal data was actually involved, you know, what systems were breached or whatnot. And, you know, obviously it involves sensitive information. So what should they report in the first instance? Because, I mean, as you know, when you report a breach, if you don't have all the facts, just report what you know within the 72 hours and you can provide further information later. But it was a bit of a sticky one because they'd found out that there was no data processing agreement in place with this supplier. So they wanted to err on the side of caution and, you know, not drop themselves if there hadn't been a breach. So we were trying to figure out the best approach, and essentially we just needed more information to determine whether a breach had actually occurred. But it got me thinking. So the definition is, let me just get it back up. So it's a
you should know it off by heart.
I know, it's the second part is like an off
like Joe
door.
Does
just goes on.
Don't say that.
But
I've got it written down here.
Yeah, I know. Same. Personal data breach means a breach of security leading to the accidental or unlawful destruction, loss, alteration, unauthorized disclosure of or access to personal data. So, you know, the breach of security would have been the malware attack. But in terms of before we knew what had actually happened, could we establish the fact that it had led to a loss of data because they turned off the systems, hence the housing association couldn't access
it? It's
the
loss of availability of data. It's the A in CIA,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
So I had the same. We had a customer, a charity, who had a ransomware attack, and they locked out their systems for a month because of the ransomware attack.
The difference here is the fact that they hadn't been locked out; they'd shut the systems down. So it's led to the loss of access, but is it direct or indirect? Does it matter?
Does it matter if it's indirect or direct? Yeah. Surely, either if there has been a breach of security that leads to a loss of data, it's just like a filing cabinet in the field, you know, it doesn't harm anybody, it's sitting in the field, it's not, you know, but, you know, it's out there, it's a loss of data temporary. And surely for loss of availability is the problem. I mean, this begs the question, you know, what is the point of availability, you know, and surely it is more about data subjects not being able to access data that they need at the point in time, or people needing to access data at a point in time to make decisions or support business decisions. And that must be the reason for availability being part of the security dimension. Yeah. Because then it disadvantages people if data is not available.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I had to have a conversation with Vicky about it because, you know, it just scrambled my head a little bit trying to think into it, because I thought if we establish a breach has happened now, at least we can take appropriate steps. But it was a conscious decision to turn off the system by the supplier. So the fact that it's a third party that's done that and it's out of, you know, the housing association's control was a question, but it wasn't unauthorized. They didn't turn it off, you know, in an unauthorized way, and it wasn't accidental. So, hence the definition hadn't necessarily
deliberate?
Been met. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure. I think, you know, I'd have to have a look at it. Jamie's saying, why would anybody have processes without contracts? And I absolutely agree with you, Jamie. But sadly, we still find that some legacy stuff, you know, it's hard to track. Track down these contracts.
Yeah.
I've got one for you then.
You know, the South Association is quite hot on the press, to be fair, but, you know, I don't know if you know, but if you experience the same thing, but, you know, when you in an organization and you're trying to implement proper measures and you know, get all of your ducks in a row, there's always things that creep out of the woodworks, whether it's from another department or legacy things. It just, it's so common. And yeah, I think usually, to be fair, when I get on a call with customers and I start talking to them about things, I don't think they like it half the time because I find work for them to do all the time. So it's quite common.
Yeah. So I'm interested in kind of think about process failures. We talked about system failures, haven't we, and human failures, but what about process failures? You know, so you've got a piece of software that lifts data and transfers it to another system overnight. You know, we use Breadwinner that transfers data between Salesforce and Xero. But if that was to go, it doesn't do it overnight, it's human driven. But if that was to go wrong, you know, the app is compromised, you know, is that a breach of security? Again, maybe it is. If we put paper documents in a pigeonhole, which still happens in education environments, you know, for a teacher to collect and they get stolen or looked at by the wrong person, is that a breach of security? You know, is that failure of process also a breach of security in the same way that you know, you can easily identify a technical failure, but I'm just wondering about these process failures, which are hard to identify as well. If data's, you know, if data's miskeyed into the wrong customer's record, is that a breach of security? It's a process failure, it's a human failing.
Yeah, but has it led to you know, one of the criteria?
Well, it might do, you know, if it's on the wrong record. If you're keying data into the wrong record, then it's not available, potentially available. It's the data integrity is impaired. Yeah. You know, confidentiality may be impaired.
Human error element, isn't it? That I think I don't know. I don't really know how to
it's a not necessarily a question to answer. It's a rhetorical training. Question to get the grey cells whirring.
Yeah, but
of a Friday afternoon.
It's a very common issue, isn't it? That it's hard to find an answer to. It's really hard to find a solution. No matter how hard you try, it's just something that comes about. But to me, I think one of the most important things in that instance is the fact that though, you know, those human error breaches and low-level breaches are actually recognized as personal data breaches, because I see it so often, you know. Or even Joe, when you was on sales, I bet you saw it all the time, where you get an organization who doesn't really take data protection seriously and they're like, oh, we never have any breaches, you know, we've never had one, it's fine. You just know that's a lie.
Can I just interject? So
or a misunderstanding.
We've assumed, right, that security is all about confidentiality, integrity, availability. That's what we read into the GDPR. It doesn't say that, does it? It says a breach of security. Does it actually mean a breach of the security principle, the sixth principle? Does it actually mean a failure to apply Article 24 and Article 32? Does it actually mean a failure to apply privacy by design and by default? Are we wrong in thinking that it's only about CIA? Should we be thinking much more broadly? And then that opens up our minds to different things that could actually represent a personal data breach. Again, I'm not asking for I'm asking for an opinion, I guess, but I'm just throwing it out there.
If they're not specifying what security actually means, we can only go on what's already in the UK GDPR, which is, like you've said, Article 32 and 24 and the privacy by design stuff. So what else can we do?
Yeah, I think it's been left broad for a reason, to be honest, because it's,
but we've narrowed it down, though. We've just spent an hour narrowing it down, saying, oh, you know, it's no breach of integrity. You know, it's just those things, leaving a cabinet of paper in a field, you know, not a problem. But I think
you know, we need something to go off. We need something to follow to be able to help to establish it. But there are instances where criteria haven't been met, and we've still thought, it still led to this. So, you know, there is some failing there that has led to one of the criteria that, you know,
have we let the techies get hold of the GDPR and narrow down the scope of security? Should we be forcing it to be broader and saying, actually, no, the reference to security in the definition of personal data is referring to Article 32, Article 24, Article, Article 6, the 60 data protection principle. It means, you know, the failure to implement technical and organizational measures actually is a breach of security, a failure. I don't know. I'm just putting it out there. Leslie's kind of saying she's had that same discussion that I have, which is good.
Yeah. I think as well, another thing that I wanted to talk about today is, you know, reportability.
We haven't even touched that. I was just wondering
last thing.
I'm just wondering whether you thought pseudonymization and anonymization, you know, the application of the storage limitation principle is actually, again, a good mitigation. You know, the proper application of it is actually a good mitigation for personal data breaches, you know, only retaining data as long as is necessary in its kind of personally identifiable format. You know, if we decide to de-identify personal data early on in processes, is that a great approach, or is it absolutely rock hard to try and make work?
It reduces the risk, obviously, but I mean, retention in and of itself is a headache for most organisations anyway. So I think, I don't know, it's probably a little bit unrealistic in most instances, even though it's something that, you know, as advisors of data protection law, we would say this is best practice, this is what you should do.
Leslie's saying, don't start me on retention. You were going to move on to notification, Jasmine, I think,
yeah,
before we get rudely interrupted.
We. Yeah, Joe. With breaches, you know, you should report breaches unless they are unlikely, well, to the ICO, unless they're unlikely to result in risk to the individual or to the data subjects involved. And the data subjects should be notified if it is likely to result in high risk. So it's all around risk. So,
yeah, but what's the point? Well, what is the point? First of all, what's the point in notifying the ICO? You know, why is the GDPR saying notify the ICO? What do they expect the ICO to do about it? Offer advice? You know, is this just meant to be a big stick in the deterrent, or is it meant to be something more pragmatic? I don't know. And surely the next bit in Article 34, notify the data subjects, you know, if it's a high risk, I mean, I get that, because then they could do something about it. But if you ring the ICO up and you say, oh, I've had this massive data breach, lost loads of, you know, information, what are they going to do about it? What is the intention of the GDPR?
Your answer's in the chat, Phil, from Jamie. It says the ICO keeps record of all breaches, so if an organisation has multiple breaches, then it will know.
Big stick.
Yeah. I mean, we spoke before about, you know, the ICO's enforcement approaches, and I think this is probably one of the biggest ways in which they do that. I think it's a struggle, isn't it, with actually raising awareness of data protection, you know, across all organizations. Either you have to know, or you do know when you take it seriously, or some maybe smaller organizations, hopefully smaller, but just don't. So it's probably is a deterrent. It is a way to raise awareness and to make sure that people actually comply with the GDPR, because there needs to be some accountability, doesn't there?
Really? Yeah, I mean, the answer is in recital 87. 87 does say that the notification may result in an intervention of the supervisory authority in accordance with its tasks and powers laid down in the regulation. So it looks like it's designed as a deterrent, but does it work? You know, do we see people rushing to improve and constantly improve their data protection, you know, because of the threat of, you know, having to notify breaches?
I think so. I think in some instances, yes, and in some maybe not, but with some organizations, you know, they really worry when a breach happens and sort of reporting to the ICO.
Worry you what, know, about getting into trouble, or worry about the effect on the data subjects?
About getting into trouble, I'd say.
Yeah, I get that as well.
Yeah. I've had a couple of people, or at least one individual who's, to be fair, is a serial breacher, just sending emails to the wrong person. There's one individual in an organisation, and she just says how she's lost sleep over it and things like that. And bless her, you know, it might not have helped change her ways because it keeps happening, but it does, you know, it does. People fear the thought of, you know, the ICO being aware of them as an organization, full stop. So
yeah, you want to keep off the radar again. I tell you, I was interested in this, because prior to the GDPR, I mean, in I think, can't remember when it was, 20 something or other, the ICO introduced mandatory breach reporting for public authorities, but up till the GDPR it was optional in the UK. I think the Netherlands introduced mandatory breach reporting in 2016. I remember that coming into effect. So I had a quick look back at the types of breaches and the sectors responsible for reporting breaches to the ICO in 2017. And top of the list was health. They had 36%, which was 3,156 reports. And education was second in the list, 11%. So that was 2017, prior to GDPR. Last month, the ISO published their figures, and the top of the tree was education and healthcare. They were accounting for 17% of all reported breaches, 17,000 of them. Health was in number two slot, 16%, at 15,000. Then local government, then finance, insurance and credit, then retail and manufacture, which is really interesting, private sector, then legal sector. Mm. Astounding, really. To me, it's astounding. Then charity and voluntary, and then general businesses, about 6,000 instances, 6% of the total. So those kind of eight sectors, yeah, represents 80% of all the reported incidents. I mean, they actually now classify them as incidents, you know, and then some of those result in data protection, personal data breaches. So I was just interested to have a look and see how that had changed. You know, still the you know, top of the trees, public authorities. Why is that? Are they reporting more? Have they got more data? Have they got more, well, you know,
just lines of interaction? Sectors that are required, you know, by law to evidence, you know, compliance with data protection legislation.
So, everyone has, haven't they?
But, you know, with the NHS, you've got the toolkit, you know, that you've got, I can't remember what it is for housing associations and so on, but I think that plays a big role in it, really.
I agree. But also, if you consider the threshold is that, you know, you've got to report it unless it's likely.
So it's a high risk process.
Yeah, so the data that they have is, it has more potential to cause risks to the data.
And I suppose retail manufacturer could be credit card information in that respect. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, good point, Joe. Yeah, you're probably right, actually. Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
So I just thought it was interesting.
That is really interesting, actually.
Also interesting Jasmine, is that under the PECA, in 2012, introduced mandatory personal data breach reporting under PECA, but only for communication providers. And they had 24, still have 24 hours to report a breach. And if you remember TikTok, was it not TikTok? TalkTalk, same type of thing, just spelled differently. And Carphone Warehouse, they got fined £1,000, which is the maximum fine leviable under the PECA for a slow notification. They got fined £1,000 for failing to report the breach on time. But 24 hours. So the ISO has actually made a statement 2 months ago saying that they were going to be, in some circumstances, a little bit more relaxed about that 24 hours and push it back to 72 hours. But again, for some organisations, that creates a bit of a two-tier system, doesn't it?
Yeah.
No, that's really interesting, to be honest. But one thing that I wanted to talk about is okay, so how do you determine whether a breach is actually reportable? What is risk that you consider? You know, what comes into that? I think some organisations, I don't know, I think it's a tricky one for those who don't live and breathe data protection, because determining the level of risk can be difficult. So you see quite often, you know, numerical approaches. So if for example, the scale is more than 50 people affected, then, you know, you score 3 points compared to if one person's affected, you score one. But for me, that's a risk in itself to take that approach, because context is so important in each and every breach. You know, it depends on what the circumstances are around that. You know, I don't know, the proximity of the effect of the recipient and the data subject, and the relationship with the controller, how the recipient has responded, if they are known to the controller, and so on.
So the risk thing is interesting. We've been working on the not only incident management piece, but also the DPIA piece within our DataWise platform, and we've reshaped the risk scoring mechanism. So it's made me think a lot about, you know, risk, identifying risk, mitigating risks, which is, you know, we've probably run out of time to talk about that kind of stuff. But you're right. You know, it's a value judgment. What you think might be high risk in some circumstances, somebody else might think of as low risk or medium risk in the same circumstances. And in other circumstances, you know, might have a completely different risk profile.
Yeah. Well, I think common sense plays a big part as well, though, doesn't it? As when you come into evaluating the risk.
Yeah. But it is hard, though, because, you know, in the support desk, when we all started practicing or reviewing data breach forms, trying to think of what risks might occur, it's tricky at first. You know, you end up thinking of the most obscure things, and it's just like,
and then you've got to think realistically, is that going to happen?
Yeah, exactly.
But I think you do have to think broadly to start with.
Yeah. Worst case scenarios, and then realistically how that might come about. But I mean, it's going back onto the topic of context, it's it's really important, because where, you know, a name and address is disclosed, you'd think generally that is really low level, it's not important. But there's a case, I can't remember for the life of me what it's called, but there was a case where you had a mother and a child fleeing domestic violence, and the husband asked the housing association what, you know, for the address of the mother and child, just probably pretending, you know, to be really innocent, and that they as if he lived there and so on. And a staff member disclosed it to him, and he went and shot the mother and child. So
yeah, that was in Birmingham, I remember that.
Yeah. So
there's been other instances of that kind of a sad thing. But yeah. I mean, you got to think of the risk in the two dimensions, haven't you? Again, I find sometimes people struggle with that, the kind of likelihood of something occurring, and then the severity of that if it does occur.
Yeah.
But anyway, I've got people are shooting now, because I've got another meeting to attend as well, I'm afraid. So I cannot hang around and chew the foul day. Although I loved it. I mean, we had tons still to talk about.
We could probably do a second session on it, to be honest. There is a lot to unpick. It's a really interesting topic, isn't it? So let us know if you'd like that. And thank you everyone for joining. Thank you, Phil, for your contributions and excitable energy. And Joe as well, thanks for your contributions. It's been a great session. And have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Cheers, guys.
See you later.
Bye. Thank you.